Attorneys ready to hear argument from petitioners in Schneider versus Bates.
May it please the court. This is one of several nuisance cases filed against Houston Ship Channel Industries. The respondents are 78 of the original plaintiffs who have all lived in close proximity to the defendant's operations for more than 2 years before the suit was filed. The issue in this case today is whether the trial court correctly determined that the plaintiffs' own pleadings and sworn affidavits filed in this case conclusively established the injuries they complained of were permanent and thus barred by limitations.
What is the general status of the litigation, all of it? Is it pretty much in the trial court or some up on appeal, or where are all these cases?
Everything other than what's before the court now has been non-suited.
Has been what?
Non-suited. Is that your question?
Yes. Okay. But I mean all of the other cases.
My understanding is that one of them is the one that Justice Brister granted summary judgment on, and that one's been settled, and I'm not aware of the status of any of them other than that one in this one.
There was one in the 334th some years ago, Allman versus Crown Central. Do you know the status of that one?
No, Your Honor, I've not come across it in the Court of Appeals, so I would assume it's either gone away or it's in the trial court.
None of the parties in that case are in this case. There's been no consolidation, nothing that you know of in that regard.
No. This court has explained that when a defendant's operations are permanent and they're in constant operation, and in a plaintiff's alleged injury from that is continuous and regularly occurs, the damages are considered permanent, and the cause of action accrues upon the first actionable injury.
What's the logic of that in terms of personal injury? Setting aside damage to land, just in terms of injury to your body, what is the logic of that type of not applying the continuing tort theory?
Well, Your Honor, under Texas law, a nuisance by definition is physical harm to property, or physical harm to a person on his or her property, or emotional harm from the deprivation of use of that property.
And what's the logic of that? Why is that a good rule?
Your Honor, the purpose behind distinguishing between permanent temporary nuisance, which a temporary nuisance basically is just application of the continuing tort doctrine. To require someone to come into court every 2 years and bring successive suits, be it for a personal injury or be it for property injury, for things that occur on someone else's land that affect you on your property.
Well, I'm not saying that if you know you're going to be injured from now on and you're choosing not to move, you're just going to choose to stay there and be injured, you could bring a suit for future damages. But why do we also at the same time have to cut off a cause of action for personal injuries that have whatever you suffered in the last 2 years simply because you or your parent or the predecessor in interest in the property didn't bring that claim 30 years ago?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think we're saying that it's because of the predecessor didn't bring a suit. And this is actually a distinction that was made in Nugent versus Pilgrim Pride, where the court held that a cause of action accrued for property damages to a prior landowner. And it said that the same claim would not be barred for the new owner's personal injury claims. And based on the unique facts in that case, it said that the discovery rule applied. So what happened is the plaintiffs came along, they bought land, they didn't realize there was something going on there. And the court said, well, technically under the law, yes, a cause of action didn't even occur to you for the permanent injuries to the land. The discovery rule would save personal injury claims in that case. And our position is not that the discovery rule would not apply to a personal injury claim in this case or any nuisance case. By definition, what the plaintiffs have alleged in their own affidavits show that they were on notice. And basically, the discovery rule just wouldn't be applicable in this case.
Well, let's suppose somebody who's living there has a child. Does that child have a claim for injuries. The parents bring it within 2 years, or if once their disability, once they're 18, they bring a claim. Or is
yes,
their claim barred because their parents claim?
And that's why the actually all the minors' claims in this suit in this case have been non-suited, because yes, there you have a window of time after the child turns 18. There's really two areas.
So you don't disagree with the Pilgrim decision, and you don't disagree with some claims arising out of this.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You don't disagree with those with the minor claim being
no.
The person.
No, Your Honor. There's two areas of current nuisance law that have really caused a lot of confusion and conflicts in the courts of appeals. One deals with the effect of intermittent weather conditions and what effect that has on the frequency and severity of a plaintiff's injury, and in turn, what effect that has on this determination of whether the injury is temporary or permanent. The other area of conflict has been in what role, if any, the possibility that a defendant's operations could be abated plays in this analysis. Now, the Court of Appeals in this case held that because there was one statement in the plaintiff's affidavits alleging that their injuries were worse when the wind was out of the south, when it rained, or when it was humid, that a fact issue existed about the frequency of the plaintiff's claims that could render this a temporary rather than permanent injury. This court has never held that if the severity of a plaintiff's injury can vary with weather conditions, but that the injury is otherwise continuing and regularly occurs such that you would presume that this is an injury that's going to continue indefinitely. This court's never held that that's enough to render it temporary. And in fact, in many cases where the plaintiff's injury was contingent wholly on an irregular force, but a constant recurring one, this court has held that damages are permanent as a matter of law. So we think the better view, although the courts of appeals have reached different conclusions about the effect of weather conditions, we think the better view was announced in the City of Lubbock versus Tice, where the court looked at odors emitted from a landfill and recognized that it wasn't 24 hours a day constant, because it affected on the weather conditions and the wind that would blow odor across the land. But the court recognized that because there was no evidence that it only occurred at long intervals, or that this wasn't regularly and constantly occurring, that based on the policies behind distinguishing between temporary and permanent nuisances, it made more sense to recognize that as a permanent injury and estimate all the damages in one suit, rather than have plaintiffs coming back into court every 2 years simply because they couldn't aver that the wind was always from the direction of the landfill.
There seems to have been some disagreement among the courts of appeals as to whether, or maybe some just loose writing, as to whether we should look at the permanent temporary nature of the injury-causing activity or of the injury. And I know that's a subject of the briefing that we need to clear up some of that confusion. But in Kraft versus Langford, we spoke in terms of the injuries. So have we already crossed that bridge?
Your Honor, I think so. I think that if you look at what this case said in Kraft and Rosenthal, Baker, Ware, the focus is initially on the defendant's operations. Is that permanent? If that is permanent, then the focus shifts to the nature of the injury. And that's when we're concerned with whether the injury is regular and ongoing.
So if the activity is permanent, and there's no question about that, but the injury is along this continuum where it's intermittent, but with longer periods between occurrences, it can still be temporary, even though the activity itself is permanent.
Yes, Your Honor.
So vacation home, you'd never have a permanent.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
So at your vacation home, you would never have a permanent nuisance.
I wouldn't say that, Your Honor. If the conditions that are causing the plaintiff's alleged injuries are regularly and constantly occurring on the property, it doesn't matter if the plaintiff is standing on the property every day. Because, again, you're looking at the policy behind this. And that's to relieve the burden on the courts and the plaintiffs and the defendant of having a plaintiff come into court every 2 years when the facts are such that it makes more sense to presume that the injury is going to be ongoing and that the damages can all be estimated in one suit. So what we're asking the court here to clarify is, exactly as I said, if the defendant's actions are undisputably permanent and the injury that derives from that is regular and constant and ongoing. It doesn't have to be literally constant. It just has to be such that it's reasonable to presume that it's gone on and it will continue to go on.
I understand the permanent temporary distinction. I think I understand it as you articulated it. But what I don't understand is why it has to be that if you don't bring the suit within 2 years after the nuisance first appears in a permanent injury case, you're barred. I mean, why does that logically follow from the whole scheme? Why is it just the scheme that injuries that occur more than 2 years before are permanently barred if it's a permanent nuisance?
Well, Your Honor, if you could make the choice of whether to bring a suit for temporary injuries or permanent, regardless of all of this court's prior case law going back to the 1800s that say that it's the characteristic that determines this. It's not, the plaintiff can't choose, well, I'm going to just sue for permanent injuries or temporary injuries.
Right, I accept that. It's okay. Going to be permanent, it's going to be temporary. The plaintiff really has no choice over that at all.
Well, Your Honor, if the plaintiff...
Okay, but that being the case, how come on a permanent nuisance your suit has to be barred forever rather than you just or lose part of your damages if you don't sue soon enough?
Your Honor, it's the same reason that it's the exact same policy for recognizing the distinction between the two. If you say that even for a permanent nuisance, one that is going to go on continuously, that, oh, you can just come into court and sue for the last 2 years, we still have successive suits. That plaintiff
no,
then...
No, you can sue for the last 2 years and for all the future. All you lose if you don't bring your suit as soon as the nuisance arose is those past damages more than 2 years before. Why is that not acceptable public policy? What is it about the nature of temporary versus permanent that makes it so important that on permanent, you bring that suit with the outset.
I don't really view it as any different than any other statute of limitations. When you've got a cause of action that accrues upon an actionable injury, we're not supposed to sleep on our rights. You're not supposed to wait 20 or 30 years to come into court and sue. And so all the policy reasons that
support... Well, if a temporary nuisance has been around for 5 years, it's still temporary because it could be stopped under the...
But
in
it's
a multifaceted
temporary.
Test, why should you be able to get 2 of the 5 years of damages?
Your Honor, it's temporary because it happens so infrequently, and there's not a reason to think that it's a continuing and ongoing thing, that it's not that you're suing for 2 years of cumulative damage. You're suing because an incident happened on this date, and you might be suing for the fact that a year and a half later, that type of incident happened, but you're not suing for a continuing character or continuing operations on the part of the defendant.
Well, if what I got from the briefing is that no single factor really is going to determine whether it's temporary or permanent nuisance. But ease of changing this nuisance or the nature of it is, all has to factor in as well as whether it happens all the time or just occasionally. Do you think that's wrong? We should really look at whether it's an everyday thing and that, or a sometime thing, and that's the sole factor.
I couldn't hear your question, Your Honor.
Never mind.
No.
I'll defer to other questioners.
Your Honor, you're absolutely right that the question of abatability and the feasibility of abatement is the other issue that has caused a lot of conflicts in the courts of appeals. And most of it's based on... May I finish my thought?
Yes.
Most of it's based on this court's holding in Crack v. Langford that an enjoinable nuisance is not a permanent nuisance. But what actually happened in Crack v. Langford was the plaintiff asked the jury for permanent injury or permanent damages, which presumes past and future. The jury awarded that, and then the plaintiff asked the trial court to enjoin the defendant's activities. And what this court held was they're mutually exclusive. You can't have future damages and have an injunction. So probably the better language in Kraft v. Lankford would have been that activity that has been enjoined cannot be a permanent injury or a permanent nuisance.
Any other questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Fonda.
May it please the court. Mr. John Turner will present argument for Ms. Fonda.
May it please the court. I'd like to begin by addressing the abatability issue with some hope that it might shed some light on the dialogue that we just heard. It's important to emphasize from our perspective that in this case, injunctive relief is a major part of the case. It's our view that...
What would that injunction look like? Could you describe it to me?
In a general way, Your Honor, it would involve things, perhaps, we don't know because we did not get the opportunity to do discovery to find out what all could be done. But from looking at publicly available documents, and particularly in the regulatory context, it was clear that for the different companies, those things might range from something as simple as less idling time for the diesel trucks, perhaps relocating the diesel trucks when they do have idling.
But towards what quantifiable end? I mean, to comply with regulations or
no.
To abate the nuisance?
To abate the nuisance, to change the operations in a way to ameliorate the conditions that represent the nuisance. That's the purpose of the injunctive relief, no question. Our goal is to fix it.
So, but you think, not having had discovery, that the defendant's operations can be changed in such a way that none of the conditions that you complain about continue to exist?
We do, Your Honor. Now, let me clarify in this respect. It is not our position that, oh, we have a silver bullet. We can go out there and every particle of emissions is going to be gone. We fully understand that there will continue to be emissions, and in fact, it's certainly possible that there may be some minimal effects on the plaintiffs. Our position is that under the current operations, they are excessive. They can be reduced. That's the critical factor. It's not that abatement means eliminating the companies. That's out of the question. There's never been an issue. It's not that the emissions can be completely eliminated. It's that the problematic conditions, the excessive conditions, can be corrected. That is our view. The decision by this court, Kraft, has already been made a significant issue in the case. In reviewing that, it seems to us that it perhaps should be emphasized that under Kraft, the law seems to be that if you can get that kind of injunctive relief, then you cannot have a permanent injury. And with that, you know, we got to thinking, and if somehow this situation were a little bit different, and our claims were not for temporary nuisance, but rather were for permanent nuisance, and the injunctive relief that has been consistently pled throughout, can we doubt for a minute that these petitioners would be in saying the plaintiffs cannot have it both ways? They can't fix it and get permanent damages.
Isn't this kind of a continuum? I guess here's my question, my overarching question. This has been there for 50 years or so, and it seems to me that when people move into this area of the county, in Harris County, they know it's stinky, they know there's pollution, and they pay lower property values for that. I mean, it seems like everybody recognizes there's a nuisance in this area, and the marketplace has taken care of that over time. In other words, when you buy a house because it's cheaper there, and you know it, you're paying a lot less price than it would be somewhere else. And so it seems like that for a long period of time, this has been a permanent nuisance. It may be that technology now has reached the point that going forward, some abatement can be done to reduce emissions. But does that change really the character of this? I mean, how do we fit that into the law?
Well, Your Honor, I think we did. We did not plead, have never pleaded, for permanent nuisance. And I agree with your honors.
You want temporary injuries and an injunction. But my point is you knew or should have known, people buying in this area, that there are emissions, and you might have to keep your windows closed, and you might be sniffling due to allergies, and your furniture might have grime on it. I mean, and you pay lower property prices because of that. So that seems like it should have all come out in the wash.
And that's the reason that permanent damages, that is the difference, in the loss of market value of the property, is not available, and as a result has not been requested.
No, but it seems like you're missing my point. The nuisance itself has been permanent for 50 years or more. The nuisance itself. The injuries you suffer are temporary, but they're as a result of a permanent nuisance. And the reason that you pay a lower property value is because you know the nuisance factor, of this permanent nuisance factor. You're trying to get us to look at the injuries versus the nuisance itself. And up until this point, the nuisance seems to me has been permanent. And you paid lower property values because of the temporary injuries that you know you will suffer because of the permanent nuisance. And going forward, it may be abatable, but does that change the character of what it's been all these years?
I would not say that anything that happens now in response to your question changes the conditions before, but I would say that's the nuisance issue. The damages from nuisance are different. They can be permanent nuisance, represents property value, market value of the property. Temporary nuisance represents perhaps rental value, but more typically physical conditions, health effects conditions, that occur on an ongoing basis. And it would be our position that, for example, if someone, as you suggested, moves out to that property, and even if they understand that, because let's say it's in an industrial area as opposed to the specific conditions that might not occur on the particular occasions when they're out there, and three or four times a year after they move out there, they find themselves going to the doctor with sinus infections or things of this nature. It's not clear to me at all. In fact, it's certainly not our position to know they've lost that because those conditions have been that way for a long time. And that's one of the other issues that we think has not gotten sufficient attention, and that is during the temporary period which we're seeking to evaluate, it's not like these plants operate in an absolutely consistent fashion day in and day out all the time. There are upsets. There are maintenance situations where, of necessity, conditions are different and emissions are different. Somebody fouls up the whole situation. Someone goes out to the property. They look at it. Gosh, this isn't bad. They move in, and after a couple of weeks, they see 29 trucks parked over there, diesel trucks, idling. They say, you know, who knew that was going to go on? Those are the types of conditions that render the complaints on which our litigation is based as a temporary nuisance, and the argument from the other side that it's, for all purposes, a permanent nuisance, incorrect.
Nobody cites an out-of-state case.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Nobody cites an out-of-state case except for two, I think. Are you aware whether other jurisdictions are wrestling with these issues or not?
One word answer, Your Honor, is no. We have not found any case that is on all fours with this situation. And in that regard, we also would note that there is another critical distinction with respect to the temporary permanent dichotomy in this case that warrants attention, and that is, in all the cases relied on by the petitioners, so far as we can tell, the emphasis is on a single operation and a single defendant. And we have not found any cases that suggest that the same rationale would necessarily apply. I'm thinking particularly of the Tice case and a couple of others. We've not found any case that suggests that, particularly at this stage of litigation, without an opportunity to do discovery, that the piggybacking of these separate facilities is not something that has to be looked at more closely.
Are you saying that after a few years of discovery, some of the defendants might turn out to be a permanent nuisance and some a temporary?
Well, the only way I
saw your argument, but I don't know where it, I couldn't tell where it leads, the fact that there's so many defendants.
I think that's a fair question. And the only answer I know how to give is we can't tell. It's certainly, but it is conceivable. It is certainly conceivable that when all the discovery is developed, the situation with respect to these companies will turn out to be markedly different.
Well, do you agree, if this were a permanent nuisance, if that's what, say you did 5 years of discovery and that's what it turned out, that some of them were permanent nuisances, do you agree that you have no cause of action for that at this time?
For permanent nuisance, we do.
Okay, so you concede that. I mean, the state of the law, at least as to that effect, you're not challenging.
That's right. And in saying that, I guess my response is that's why I wasn't glad.
Would you agree that light or noise pollution would be permanent?
Your Honor, that's a little bit of a mixed bag. With respect to the light situation, that obviously is going to tend to be more uniform in our view. The critical question in that regard is abatement. Is there something that is reasonably available that could change those conditions that equity would dictate ought to be done?
Is that going to vary from plaintiff to plaintiff, whether it's temporary or permanent, based on how often it affects them?
Conceivably, Your Honor, my impression would be that I guess what you're saying is some plaintiffs might be severely bothered by the light, and the light is much more excessive at their particular residence than someone else, and certainly that's a possibility.
But it's undisputed that, let's just take light, for example, it's there 24/7, and it's not really abatable. So would you say that's permanent?
Well, I'm not sure how we can say that it's been conclusively established that those conditions are not abatable. They're not abatable, it's true, in the sense that it is necessary for those premises to be lighted. But that is not dispositive of the question of whether they can be lighted in an adequate way, but one that does not have the same level of impact on the plaintiffs. So that's the critical distinction in that regard. With respect to the noise, it's somewhat similar. There is a certain amount of noise that is indigenous to all industrial operations, and it would be our view that type of noise probably would represent a permanent nuisance. I think it's important, though, that the noise issue also extends to off-normal type situations, unusual noises, at least described as, whether it's precisely accurate or not, explosions, periodic loud bangings, and things like that. And again, in the case of some of the defendants, that might extend to the trucks. You know, you have a whole convoy of trucks, you know, going in or out at a particular time. Maybe it's once a day, maybe it's once a week. The point is that to perhaps a greater extent than the situation of the light, the noise is a variable type of factor.
If there's some refinery process that requires a loud noise every 2 weeks for, say, 30 minutes, maybe that's inherent in shutdown or something like that. And is that permanent or temporary? It's been going on for 30 years, but it just happens occasionally. But to abate it would be, at least under current technology, you know, radical change in the way it operates.
Well, let me answer that in a couple of ways. To the extent that it's abatable, then I would argue that it may represent a temporary nuisance for that reason alone.
Let's just assume it's not.
If it is not abatable.
This is just something that happens. It doesn't happen very often, but it happens regularly.
That's right. And you get into those difficult issues, how often is too often, how regular is too regular. I would agree that there is a point where probably a consensus could be reached that, yes, this represents a permanent nuisance. Certainly on this state of the record, I am not prepared to say what that would be in this case.
It seems to me like the foundation of your case is we just don't know yet. There's too many defendants, too much happening out there, and the trial court abused its discretion in not letting us know.
Certainly, Your Honor, that is a key portion of our position at this stage, and I think that's what the Court of Appeals concluded.
And that's a high burden to show the trial court abused that discretion.
What the Court of Appeals said is because the plaintiffs sometimes in their own affidavits said it's continuous and sometimes said, well, it just arises sometimes, that created a fact question. You don't need to do discovery from your own clients, right? I mean, didn't they base it on what was in the client's affidavits?
I think that's correct.
So you didn't need to do discovery. You just ask them that.
But in that regard, our concern is with the spin that's been placed on the language, the conversational language that was used in those affidavits. The first thing that's critical in that respect is that the affidavits do clearly predicate all those nasty words seized on by the other side as circumstances when the wind is blowing, at least generally, from the direction of the plants. And that falls clearly within the scope of the Youngblood case cited in all the briefs and the Gulf Coast sailboats.
But over a period of years, the wind's going to blow a certain way regularly. So when you're looking at the affidavits that say the conditions are, for example, ongoing and occur frequently, would it be fair to summarize your position as, yes, that could indicate permanent injury as a matter of law unless we can get discovery to show that it would be available?
Not completely, Your Honor, no. And the reason that I say that is Gulf Coast sailboats. You know, we're not prepared to say that this court fouled up in when they NRE'd that case. Our argument would be that the conditions being articulated by our clients and that are involved in this case are not markedly different from those found to be a temporary nuisance in the Gulf Coast sailboats case. And it's our view that the posture of the other side is essentially that, gosh, you know, when the Youngblood case and the Gulf Coast sailboats case were NRE'd, somebody just fouled up, and that's got to be fixed. And that's on the basis primarily of the Tice case, which this court did not get the opportunity to review. So I would have to say, Your Honor, that we would argue that point on that basis as well as the availability issue.
Can you tell me what the... I'm interested in your attempts to get more discovery at the trial court level and how soon and how thoroughly you urged that in front of the trial court after you... Well, during or after the time you were working on your own long-time discovery responses.
I'm sorry, Ron, I'm not...
Well, I'm interested in your point that the trial court abuses discretion in not giving you more time for discovery before taking all these claims out by summary judgment. But obviously that's a very high burden for you to show, and I'm trying to get more of a feel than the brief showed.
I understand, Your Honor. Let me perhaps correct myself. It's not our view that we're in a position of having to argue that the trial court abused its discretion with respect to that or any other particular issue in this case. In fact, as we see it under Kraft and other decision, it is the burden of the moving party for summary judgment to disprove, for example, the availability issue. And I want to make that point. It is our view that from a fact standpoint, we can much better sustain and defend our position if we have the opportunity to do conventional discovery with respect to the operations of various defendants.
So your main point is they didn't meet their summary judgment burden. And your subsidiary point is if we disagree with it, with that contention, and we could.
I think so. I think our position is they did not meet their burden, and we could have done even better in explaining our position if we would have the opportunity to do discovery.
Okay, let me just follow up on my last question, because maybe as to the statements that are in the plaintiff's affidavits, there's no more discovery needed on that point for us to determine as a matter of law whether this is permanent or temporary.
I mean,
putting debatability aside.
I respectfully disagree.
Well, all right, but again, debatability aside, we've got Gulf Coast sailboats. City of Lubbock seems to be different. Would you agree with that?
I would agree, Your Honor, that it's difficult to reconcile
the
City of Lubbock and its ties and
so if we were to go with the City of Lubbock route, if we agreed with that case, for example, then we could determine based on these plaintiffs' affidavits as a matter of law, permanent versus temporary, abatability issue aside.
Probably so. This court,
so there wouldn't need to be any more discovery to make that determination if we were to go with City of Lubbock. In other words, you don't need any more discovery from the plaintiffs on that piece.
Not from the plaintiffs.
But so then the only relevant discovery you would need, you would argue then, would be on the abatability piece.
In terms of discovery, that's correct, Your Honor. But the concern that we have with respect to the affidavits is the petitioners are effectively taking the position they are based on the inferences from those affidavits. Our position is that, again, that language was used in a conversational sense. By the terms, it was limited to conditions when the wind was prevailing from the companies. My teenage son has always got his head in the refrigerator. Well, how often is that, really? So we think there may be some questions, but we agree if the court were to conclude that Tice is correct and that Gulf Coast Sailboat was erroneously decided and that the Youngblood case was erroneously decided and those cases should not have been NRE, then in large, large measure, our position would rest on the debatability issue.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Ron.
The respondent makes much of the fact that all the cases you cite actually went through a trial, and we have the records. Is it the case that it's a little unusual to get a summary judgment at this stage of a nuisance proceeding?
Your Honor, not every case that we've cited is following a trial. And sorry, I don't want to take up my time here going through notes, but I'm happy to file a supplemental brief with you because absolutely not.
I'll just look at somebody will look at the cases in your book.
Okay, so help me plug in the abatability piece.
Absolutely.
An argument that's been made that if the effects can be lessened through injunctive relief, that indicates that perhaps the injury is temporary and they need more time to be able to determine that.
Your Honor, our position is, let me back up just a little bit. The Court of Appeals held that there was a fact question about the feasibility of abatement in this case, and for that reason, summary judgment was improper. There's two things wrong with that, but the main thing wrong with that is the feasibility of an injunction is never a fact issue. I mean, an injunction is an equitable remedy that the trial court can decide to grant. It's not anything that ever goes to the jury. And so what the plaintiffs have really complained about here is that, well, if we could have gotten more discovery, we could have told the trial court in more detail what we were going to ask them to do, and then the trial court could have determined if it was going to grant injunctive relief. A trial court's decision about whether or not to grant injunctive relief is reviewed for abuse of discretion, as is the question of whether a trial court should have allowed more time for discovery before summary judgment is granted. In this case, the trial court had before it, from the plaintiff's experts' affidavits, very detailed information about the types of injunctive relief the plaintiffs would be looking for if they found what they were looking
but
for.
Let's go to
their
the,
discovery.
They gave the example of the idling. They could there could be injunctions saying you can't idle your engines more than X period of time. Let's say that were the case. Let's say there were evidence to show that if the idling time, if the defendants were enjoined from allowing their trucks to run more than X period of idling time, that would be enough to lessen the effects of the operation so that it wouldn't be a nuisance anymore. Mm-hmm. Would that affect the temporary permanent nature of the plaintiff's claims?
Your Honor, it wouldn't, because what would be important in looking at that would be, is this the type of injunctive relief that a trial court is going to grant an injunction on that will abate it? The theoretical idea that anything that is man-made could be abated. A court could say, turn the switch off on the plant, or the court could say, reduce your idling time.
Well, but their argument with that is that there's a continuum there as well. It doesn't necessarily have to shut it down, but you could put restrictions that would be enough to abate the nuisance without shutting it
but
down.
But, Your Honor, it's within the trial court's discretion in this case to look at this list of things and make the decision. The court's not going to micromanage these things. So even if the plaintiffs say, well, if we had all this other discovery, maybe they could pave this. Maybe they could reduce idling time. They could pave this. They could use different types of
would there be any nuisance ever that couldn't be lessened a little?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
So that would swallow the whole rule?
Absolutely. And especially in this case, Your Honor, a lot of the things that the plaintiffs have set forth and said, well, they could use bag houses, they could use this and that, these are reasonable things. These are all things that are regulated by the...
No, I understand that argument. I'm just trying to plug in this language about if it's abatable, that's some indication that it's temporary, and I don't know what that means. It's a characteristic of temporary. I'm having a hard time understanding what that language in Kraft means in a broader context.
Your Honor, I believe the better reading of Kraft is because an injunction had issued, because a court had exercised its discretion to say, I'm going to permanently enjoin the defendant's activities, it couldn't have been a permanent nuisance. That's not the case we have here.
But you would say more as a matter of election of remedy than as the nature of the activity.
Yes, I think it's putting the cart before the horse to say that because anything could theoretically be abated by trial court, whether by a reasonable measure or not, that would affect the determination in the first instance of whether it's a permanent or a temporary nuisance.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments of today's causes, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All right. Oyez, oyez, oyez.